Chapter 2, Sanctuary and Books and Nature. In the summer of 1956, my father traveled from New Orleans to Kansas City. There he was to meet my mother's sister and her husband, Mildred and Wally Hatcher, who were scheduled to arrive on a United Airlines flight from Los Angeles. The flight was late. He inquired at the ticket counter and was told that there was some sort of problem. The ticket personnel would say no more. Father paced the corridors of the airport and finally, after waiting for hours with the other anxious relatives of the plane's passengers, he went out to his car and switched on the radio. A newsflash reported that my aunt and uncle's plane had collided with another passenger plane over the Grand Canyon in the worst civilian air disaster in history. The tragedy ultimately changed Mother and the rest of my family in profound ways. My mother, Alice Maxine Crick, had grown up pampered and protected in Independence, Missouri. Her father, Thomas Crick, an inventor turned stove manufacturer, had built one of the largest companies in the Kansas City area. Mother always seemed a little frail and thin after a youthful bout with scarlet fever. During her illness, Mother's sisters, Mildred and Madeline, stayed with her, caring for her, wiping away the fevered sweat and saying prayers by the bed. As Mother recovered, the two girls played hands of cards with her, and invariably Mother almost always won. It was a skill that remained with her until she had a stroke 3 years before her death. After her death in 1993, I found one of Mother's high school yearbooks. Her classmates had filled it with beautifully written original poems and erudite inscriptions. They were all in a crisp, fine penmanship. I compared her yearbook to one of my own yearbooks and wondered about the so-called progress education has made in this century. I also found a photograph of the young Maxine Crick. She was uncharacteristically serious-looking, almost studious, with her hair flowing in a golden wave around the perfect face and her large eyes looking deep blue, even in the black and white snapshot. She was already tall enough at 5'10" that she seemed almost too thin, but the photographer had captured on film something about her that matched a description of her I had found in the yearbook. She was indeed angelic. In 1932, a young man who was working his way through college with a job at Central Drug Store in Kansas City took an interest in Alice Maxine Crick. She in turn admired the aproned young man who filled prescriptions, cleaned the floors, and made sodas. When he donned his Army Reserve officer's uniform, he looked the part of a man moving up in the world. The young man's name was David Hedger Duke. My father's mother, Florence Hedger, who had been a chemistry professor at Kansas University and co-author of textbooks in that discipline, and that was long before the days of women's liberation, had died when my father was 12. His father grew up on a farm 8 miles straight west of the University of Kansas in Lawrence. There he met and romanced Professor Hedger, whom he married in 1910. Ernest M. Duke had left college his senior year to support his father's family as well as his own new family. He worked for the U.S. Postal Service. My father held jobs consistently from grade school onward to help support his family, which was quite financially stretched by the need of his father to support two families at the same time. Because the Duke house was small, Father had to sleep beneath layers of quilts on an unheated back porch. Winter mornings in Kansas City can sometimes hit zero. Every morning he would rise at 4 a.m. and deliver the Kansas City Star, finish in time for school at 8 a.m. and then the Star's evening edition right after school, all on foot. Father worked his way through junior college and college at KU, always carrying a full-time job. He and Maxine married after his graduation in 1936. Afterward, he went to work for Shell Oil as a petroleum engineer. He was on active duty during the Second World War from 1940 until 1946, and then went on inactive duty as a full colonel and remained in active reserves through the 1960s. Although years and miles had separated mother's sisters, it seemed letters filled with pictures of their husbands and children were always in our mailbox. Father would always protest mother's long telephone conversations and would scold her about the bill. But every month, just the same, the bills came high. I cannot recall the details of how mother first received the news of Aunt Mildred and Uncle Wally's deaths in the Grand Canyon crash, but I faintly remember the black and white images on TV and the heavy black headlines in the pages of the New Orleans newspaper, which lay about the house like shrouds. I remember the sound of mother's sobbing, and our always affectionate dog, Frisky, trying to lick the streaks of tears from mother's drawn face and from the clenched hands that collected the glistening droplets. To my sister and me, it seemed like the end of the world. The end not only for Aunt Mildred and Uncle Wally, but for us too. For 3 days and nights, we cried together, a little girl, a little boy, and their distraught mother draped out across a bed in anguish. Dottie and I did not cry only for our aunt and uncle and our orphaned cousins. We hurt for our mother. We cried with her just as we laughed when she had laughed. Her tears were as contagious as her laughter, and the sadness we saw in each other just gave it an inertia of its own. Every time the television repeated the breaking news about the crash, the words seared us, telling us again that the disaster was real and not just some awful nightmare on a humid summer night in New Orleans. Order returned to the household when Father got home from Kansas City. During his absence, Dottie and I had slept in Mother's arms or on the carpet at the foot of the bed. Dottie and I were made to return to our own beds as soon as Father came. In my room during the nights that followed, it occurred to me that I was blessed where my cousins were cursed. Death had taken their mother and father, but had spared mine. I was home, safe in my room, in the home occupied by my mother and father and sister. But then mother left. She packed her things and departed for a few weeks' stay in California, where she was to look after my cousins. Father, even with his military bearing and heavy job responsibilities, quickly adapted to mother's roles. He woke Dottie and me in the morning, fed us a good breakfast, usually oatmeal because it sticks to the ribs, and made sure we got dressed appropriately and left for school on time. In California, while caring for and trying to comfort Mildred's distraught children, Mother went on grieving, as she had in those first few days after hearing the news. She sought solace in alcohol, and by the time she returned to Louisiana 2 months later, she was an alcoholic. It all happened as quickly as that. I was too young then to understand that Mother suffered from a drinking problem even before the crash, and that Aunt Mildred's death had simply tipped it beyond control. Upon her return from California, Mother seldom got up in the morning to cook us breakfast and get us off to school. She had been an excellent golfer and still sometimes went to the golf course, but now she spent more time in the clubhouse playing cards and drinking with the other ladies than trying for birdies. Mother's condition continued to deteriorate. She withdrew more and more from the lives of my father and Dottie and me. Often when I tried to tell her about my latest adventures or just talk to her after coming home from school, I found her incoherent, her speech slurred, and her movements spastic. Because I had been ashamed after one of my visiting friends saw her intoxicated, I seldom brought friends into our house thereafter. I became determined, though, to battle the disease. One evening I prayed for hours, kneeling on my bed in the quiet of my upstairs room, tearfully asking God to make Mother well. I would sometimes search for her hidden bourbon bottles and grimly pour them down the kitchen drain. I reacted to the drama in my home by growing up faster than most of my friends. Father kept his patience through it all. He loved Mother as deeply as Dottie and I, and her condition wounded him terribly. It seemed that hardly a day went by without his pleading with her to stop drinking. Sometimes he got her to promise to stop, but inevitably, within a few days or sometimes after a few weeks, he would return home from work and find her alone in the bedroom, quietly drinking bourbon and Coca-Cola. Father coped with Mother's drinking as he dealt with every other hardship in his life. He immersed himself in work. He arose about 4:30 a.m. and worked at home for a couple of hours, and then, just as he had during Mother's absence in California, every day he made Dottie and me breakfast and sent us off to school. Then he would go off to work at Shell. After work, he would don his construction clothes and go out to supervise his small construction company's home building. Back at home later in the evenings, he would work on engineering projects for Shell or on the blueprints for another home. Often, Father would take me with him to construction sites after I got home from school, and we would work side by side on carpentry, plumbing, wiring, roofing, and painting. He had learned some of these trades from his father, who in turn had learned them from his father. Some of the tools Father and I used were my grandfather's and great-grandfather's, and I still have them to this day. The knowledge of how to use them had also been passed down, and even then I was thankful for the inheritance. I was in awe of my father. It seemed he could do nothing wrong, and that he could do just about anything, and he just about could. He designed the houses he built right down to the most minute intricacies specified in the blueprints, and he could build a house from the ground up using his own mind and muscle. Father sometimes paid me $1 an hour for my labors, which I thought was a fortune in those times, but he gave me such a generous salary on the condition that I saved at least half of it. By the time I was 12, I could plane a door, successfully drive a nail at just the right angle, and caulk, prime, or paint a window frame, as well as any skilled adult laborer. I also had a good bankroll for a 12-year-old, and every penny of it I had earned. Just as Mother withdrew from her family into the depths of alcoholism, and as Father found his relief from the circumstances at home by withdrawing into his work, I withdrew too. I found my sanctuary in books and my chemistry set. Inspired by the movie Swiss Family Robinson, I built a crude treehouse in the backyard willow with old pieces of driftwood for foot and handholds. Here I could devour books and National Geographic and Science Digest and Popular Mechanics and Scientific American, my favorite magazines. As I grew a little older, I found my greatest sanctuary in the lush swampland and bayou country along Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans East. 2 or 3 afternoons a week over a period of 3 years, I rode my bike a few short miles and entered a biologist's dream. Amphibians, reptiles, and small mammals such as nutria, rabbits, squirrels, wild pigs, fish, and thousands of insects and birds, as well as varied flora, filled these nearby swamps and cypress and pine forests. Soon I was collecting and caging creatures of every kind. I kept them in the backyard or garage: water turtles, box turtles, chameleons, toads, baby squirrels, snakes, bats, tadpoles, frogs, and every kind of strange insect. I learned to distinguish which species of insects and other creatures that I could safely pick up, and those that had a painful bite or sting. I knew which snakes were venomous, and I could tell which of the non-venomous ones had a dangerous and painful bite. I knew which snakes would wrap themselves around my arms, almost in an embrace, but never bite, not even when provoked. A blue runner once twisted in my hand and bit me so hard between my thumb and forefinger that it drew streams of blood. I wiped the blood on my t-shirt and wore this red badge proudly as I rode my bike home late that afternoon. Over the years, I became quite an expert on being bitten. I was unceremoniously bitten by a crow I'd captured, by a young squirrel, and once even by a bat that I had found with a broken wing. I knew about the dangers of rabies, but I never told my parents about the bites because I feared the rabies vaccine series more than the disease. Once a furry humpbacked caterpillar stung me so badly that I returned home in searing pain. And that was made a lot worse by the sight of red streaks that ran up under the skin of my forearm. But before I'd gone to bed that evening after a trip to the doctor, I was planning my next excursion into the swamps. The swamp, with its forbidding stagnant waters and algae, its lush undergrowth, venomous snakes, wild boar, and ravenous mosquitoes, kept out all but the most hardy of human trespassers. But my friends and I craved the hardships and, frankly, the danger. We thrived on them. No matter how the gnats, flies, mosquitoes, brambles, or poison ivy and oak struck at our flesh, we would not be kept from our muddy wonderland. We just brushed the insects away or smashed them into our skin. Bumps and rashes and frequent itching were just the price of admission, an entrance fee that we quickly forgot. Perhaps the love of nature that I developed as a child was an expression of the genes of my forefathers who lived many generations by farming. Every farmer knows not only the tilled soil, but also the natural life beyond the plowed fields and barnyards. On long summer days, I rode my bicycle to the swamps and forests around New Orleans, and here I loved the bright sun, the humid breeze across the swampland, the shade of the live oak trees that gave me respite on the hottest days. Under their moss-draped branches, I rested on mats of naturally worn grass, thicker and softer than the plushest carpet. From there I gazed up wide-eyed at the needle-like rays of sunlight that pierced the green canopy of leaves and shot beams of energy into the shade. Here, far away from the noise of the city, I heard the calls of frogs and birds and always listened for the faintest murmurs of life. And I would find such in the reeds and ivy. In the brackish waters of Lake Pontchartrain, I could dive down 4 yards to the cool, squishy mud at the bottom and then blast upward, flying to the surface world of sky and air. With only crooked sticks and bare hands, my friends and I would capture water moccasins and rattlers, as well as a number of other reptiles, which we could sell to the snake farm nearby Slidell. Twice I encountered wild pigs that came hurtling at me, razor-sharp tusks leading their way. Both times I escaped into algae-covered pools. I am firmly convinced that facing such dangers, I was not so much brave, but simply accustomed to the risk. We were no braver than the boar that charged us. We were in the swamp and the forest because it answered the natural longings inside of us to be there. I had no thought of the threat to my life any more than the wild pig had. Never was I more alive than in those days of long ago. My friends and I would ride down a break in the muck and shoulder-high weeds called Dead Man's Road. It was called that because on it the police had found once a body that was never identified. We would hide our bikes in the bushes just off the overgrown path and walk a half mile back into the mire, the trees and brush, alternating open and algae-covered stagnant water and brown sandy banks or grassy dry areas. No one, not even the hunters who would sometimes come down the muddy road in search of rabbit, squirrel, wild pig, or gator, would venture even 10 yards from Dead Man's Road. The foliage was too thick, the water and mud too deep. But they were not too deep for us. I once worked for a month hollowing a canoe out of an old log, and I remember my disappointment the day I put her in the water, and she turned over to a perfectly balanced, upside-down float. Defeated, I filled her with water and unceremoniously scuttled her, but I couldn't even succeed in doing that, for all she did was float off, upside down. A month later, I found an abandoned Indian-style canoe and patched her up. She floated upright, thankfully, and for the next 2 years, whenever I wanted, she carried me faithfully and swiftly to the most remote places of the swamp. After many months, I knew every piece of solid ground, the depth of every stagnant pool. I knew where I could find mud or sand or thick stands of trees, and exactly where I could find algae-free water. I learned all the things that I could eat and where to look for them. Hearts of palm, fish, wild onions, strawberries, radishes, raspberries, all of them were there for the taking, and I ravenously helped myself to this wild banquet. And the fish. Never have I eaten better tasting fish. The fishing was wonderful in the almost inaccessible bayous and ponds. All I needed was a cane pole or even a broken branch, some fishing line, some dry wood for a cork, and a fish hook or two. The bait was always easy to find. I could whoosh out of the shallow, warm, muddy water all the minnows, tadpoles, frogs, or tiny fish I needed. Or I could turn over the rich black soil and uncover more earthworms than needed for 100 hooks. I would clean the fish and impale them on a stick over a small smoky fire and sear them to perfection. As for water in a couple of choice spots, I kept a couple of old Clorox bottles cut in half with screen wire over them to keep out mosquitoes and their larvae. In rainy South Louisiana, the bottles stayed full of the finest distilled water to quench my thirst, a gift from heaven. Only twice do I remember seeing anyone other than my friends in these remote areas. Once an old Cajun in a carved cypress pirogue saw me trudging through the mud and said nothing to me as he, with unbroken strokes, paddled silently on through the reeds and out of sight. And once, when my friend and I returned to Dead Man's Road from an afternoon in the swamp, there stood my companion's father, angry. He was muddied to his knees from searching for the son he thought lost in the swamp. My friend's father could not understand why we were back in that, what he called, God-forsaken place. It struck me as odd then that anyone would call the place I so loved God-forsaken. To me, the swamps and cypress woods of the New Orleans East area spoke God's word as eloquently as the Bible itself. During this period, I read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, the book that popularized environmental thinking in the 1960s. From the first few words I read, the ideas of ecological preservation became as real to me as the nature I played and swam in almost every day. I also devotedly read the fascinating books by Theodore Roosevelt on his great safaris in the wilds of Africa and the Amazon. They gave me my first understanding that the science and the nature that I so loved had a relationship to government and society as a whole, for people could respect or destroy the natural world. Politics might have more importance than it seemed to me on first thought. Still, I found it then very boring compared to the life I found in nature and the science that explained its secrets. We also had definite ideas of the behavior of men and women. For us, it was taboo to cry. No matter how it hurt, a man was simply not supposed to cry. Perhaps the only exception to that was a funeral. At the age of 11, when a car ran over my dog, Frisky, I gathered her broken body up off the street and felt death closely for the first time. In fact, although she only weighed 12 pounds, she had no rigidity beneath her coat, and I found to my horror when I went to pick her up that her insides just slipped about like a liquid in a plastic sack. Somehow, I got her back to the house and laid her down in the backyard. For half of my young life, Frisky was with me constantly. She slept at the foot of my bed, followed me to the ball fields and even into the swamp with a loyalty seldom found in humans. I was as devoted to her as she was to me, and now I knew that those were the last moments I would ever see her, our pet, her slick coat. It hurt to think that she would never run by my side or explore with me again the swamps near my home. As I laid her still warm body in a bed of dark green clover, I thought about the times that she had consoled me with her bright eyes and wagging tail when I was down, and how with her sharp pointed ears she could hear my voice calling from almost anywhere in the neighborhood, and she always came running to my call. As I dug the damp grave, my sweat poured out, and I wasn't sure whether it was tears or just sweat that stung my eyes. Later that night, an ache welled up in my chest that hurt worse than anything I'd ever felt. I turned my head to my pillow and cried. Even then, I was determined to be a man about it, so I willed myself not to make a single sob, not a noise. I gritted my teeth and buried my head deeper into the pillows, fighting the tears, but still they streamed and dampened my pillow. I understood that a man could feel great pain and hardship, but it was something that, except in extraordinary circumstances, he did not show in public. There were, however, a few times, in the most private moments of my youth, when my emotions would spill out on my sleeves or my pillow. The death of Frisky was one of those rare times. In fact, in those times, my friends and I viewed it as quite weird for men even to hug one another, save instances such as a funeral where men would use a hug to comfort the bereaved. Yet, even then, such physical contact seemed awkward. At a friend's grandfather's funeral, I noticed how when men hugged, even in grief, they often did so like dancers out of step. Of course, my mother wanted the hugs and kisses that all mothers require, and I obliged her. But with the onset of puberty, my father seldom hugged me, nor did I want such girlish displays of affection. We shook hands, but those firm handshakes expressed the love of father and son in a complete way that I still remember with great pleasure today. Mother gave Father and Dottie and me her love and her concern, as well as moments of anguish. But most of all, I recall her loving and sensitive spirit, her playfulness and laughter. Sometimes I think that her acute sensitivity and idealism were factors in her withdrawal into alcoholism. When life turned out to be not so idyllic, she found refuge in drink. Today, when critics claim that my political opinions are the result of the wrong kind of upbringing or an unhappy childhood, a dysfunctional family burdened by alcoholism, I think that, on the contrary, Mother made me care about the important things of life more than I could have otherwise. Her alcoholism, for instance, is what led me to my first social consciousness. On the brink of my teenage years, I contemplated the injury that alcohol had inflicted upon my family. Because I personally felt its tragedy, I realized that behind the grim statistics of tremendous societal damage were real families suffering like my own. Alcohol. How many millions of marriages has it ruined, careers smashed, auto deaths and disfigurements caused? How many robberies, murders, and rapes has it encouraged? How many millions of assaults has it initiated? How many millions have lost health or faced agonizing death from the substance? I thought about how the movie industry glamorized drinking and made it fashionable. In the movies, all the beautiful and successful people come in from a hard day of work and mix a martini or pour a scotch on the rocks. The lesson is clear. If one faces depression, have a drink. If one is elated, have a drink. If one needs to calm down, have a drink. If one celebrates, have a drink. Yet, in spite of mother's affliction, I too was swept along with the peer pressure. I remember the first time I drank too much at a party and how sick I felt afterward. A couple of days later, my friends and I, trying to appear grown-up, began to brag about getting drunk. I realized then that I'd let myself be controlled by fashion rather than doing what was right. Even before I became a teenager, I realized that the only real victory over alcohol abuse could not come by laws, but by a mass media and government that promoted an entirely different value system, one that made a higher ethic of a bright mind and healthy body more fashionable than getting high on alcohol or any drug. Mother lived the last few years of her life with my sister's family in Oregon, due in great part to Dottie's care and dedication. Mother eventually conquered her drinking problem. I visited her shortly after my election to the Louisiana House of Representatives in 1990, and she was pleased about my victory. She was bedridden, and I sat beside her on the bed while we talked. I wanted her to know that I held not the slightest resentment toward her for the sad times she sometimes brought me as a child. In fact, I told her I was grateful to her. Not only had she given me half my genes, but during my boyhood, she had given me a precious gift. In her own challenges and frailty, she had made me care more intensely about life and family, more so than if there had been no struggle at home. And in my search for sanctuary from those problems, I discovered the beauty in nature and my love of science and books. She had given me more than she ever thought, and I was thankful to her. I thank God that I could let her know my feelings in the twilight of her life. The last time I saw Mother was a few weeks before her death in 1993. A terrible stroke had paralyzed her, and she couldn't talk well, but she could smile and write messages on an erasable board. Although her sickness had weakened her body, she still had that same beautiful light in her eyes that caused a high school admirer to write in the yearbook of her angelic beauty. A few weeks later, she was buried at a national cemetery on a hillside in full view of a snow-capped Mount Hood. The next chapter is Chapter 3, Son of the South.